Palestinians facing genocide. It is our moral and professional obligation to speak out about children being harmed in the ways that they are in Gaza, about hospitals and the whole healthcare structure being destroyed in Gaza, and about our healthcare colleagues who have been abducted, tortured, and killed in Gaza.
Dr. Maria,
we cannot be silent. We must push back.
Dr. Maria, you were named one of the top 20 most influential women in biomedicine by Nature. You've served on multiple national advisory boards, but that didn't shield you from institutional reprisal. And since your firing, over 1,000 healthcare workers and students have signed open letters demanding your reinstatement, denouncing UCF's suppression of political expression. In this last 20 seconds, what does this kind of support mean? And do you think you might be reinstated?
Solidarity is the only thing we have. It's our superpower to fight authoritarianism, fascism, and this kind of racist repression. So I ask for all healthcare workers around the world to stand in solidarity with me, because my fight is our fight, and our fight is for the liberation of Palestine and our collective liberation. Thank you.
Dr. Rupa Maria, physician, activist, author, and composer, fired in late May by the University of California, San Francisco, now filed a First Amendment lawsuit against UCFF as well as a civil rights lawsuit. That does it for our show. We have three job openings. Go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Join KABU around the campfire. Become a member during Camp KABU's Summer Drive, taking place now through June 29th. Your contribution goes towards grassroots community radio. Donate now by going to kabu.fm/give. Thank you.
Support for KABU comes from KABU members and Grendel's Coffee Shop, located at East Burnside and 8th Avenue in Portland, featuring coffee, tea, sandwiches, and more. Information at grendelspdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on this summer membership drive special of the KABU Evening News, private contractors hired by the Department of State Lands are macing activists at Sandy River Delta Camp Sweep.
Portland City Task Force wants to break ground on 2,500 more homes by 2030.
And the City of Portland will pay out $8.5 million in settlement funds to 26 descendants of Black Portlanders who were driven out of their homes and businesses in the late 1950s through the 1970s.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Friday, June 6th, 2025. KABU is currently in our summer membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Nina Mayfair.
And I'm Sam Bowman. Since June 2nd, hired private contractors have been attempting to remove a long-standing camp at the Sandy River Delta. The Department of State Lands, or DSL, has hired contractors from Northwest Hazmat in partnership with the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office to remove camp homes, the people living in them, and allies at a camp near Thousand Acres Sandy River Delta. DSL has closed 50 acres of the park to conduct the sweep and plans on reopening the area October 1st. DSL posted some notices in March of 2024 of the proposed Sandy River Delta cleanup timeline, and then posted notices of a May through October closure. The sign said that the area would be closed for ecological restoration. It did not specify a camp sweep. This has happened in the past, explained Grizzly, a resident of the Sandy River Delta camp, but they said, quote, "The other notices in the past were signed by a judge as a court order, and they would give us 30 days, but we would be able to come back and have a place to go, end quote. Grizzly and his neighbors, some of whom have been there for decades, had just 3 days to prepare to leave, and many are concerned about having time to pack while there are actively people in their camps throwing their things away. Two videos have been released of two separate instances when private contractors maced activists when they tried to block their way into the camp. According to Western Regional Advocacy Project, many of the people who are currently living in that camp were directed there by county law enforcement. For years, the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office has been dropping off houseless individuals at Thousand Acres when they are released from the county jail. The camp sweeps have been carried out despite a cooperative stewardship proposal that was offered by the residents of the camp.
The city of Portland will pay out $8.5 million in settlement funds to 26 descendants of Black Portlanders driven from homes and businesses from the late 1950s through the 70s. The descendants filed a federal civil rights lawsuit in U.S. District Court in late 2022, arguing that the city, Emmanuel Legacy Medical Center, and Prosper Portland, an economic and urban development agency, conspired to destroy a thriving Black neighborhood. Yesterday, Portland City Council unanimously signed on to a higher settlement among the parties. The original financial settlement proposed to the council was $2 million. After testimony from the community, including descendants, all 12 councilors voted to increase the amount, another $6.5 million. Council President Elena Pirtle-Jinky said, quote, "It was taken not by accident. It happened through public policy. The urban renewal and eminent domain, rezoning and decisions made by the government, including by our predecessors on this city council, displaced Black Portlanders and disrupted generational progress," end quote. She acknowledged the process has been painful for the families involved and said the settlement is not a full restoration. As a condition of the settlement, the lawsuit will be dismissed and the descendants will get financial and land retribution, in addition to other terms. The Central Albina neighborhood was an active hub for many Black-owned businesses in the 1940s. In the 50s, the city began to displace hundreds of residents there to make way for Interstate 5. Later that decade, the City Portland Development Commission, now called Prosper Portland, and Emmanuel Legacy Medical Center received federal urban renewal grants to expand the hospital and, quote, remove blight from the area, resulting in the displacement of more than 150 residents. The hospital expansion was not fully realized. Instead, plots of land that had been single-family homes in the 1940s have sat empty or have been used for parking.
It is relatively unusual for city councilors to increase such a settlement. After Loretta Smith of District 1 read the motion to increase the amount, snaps, cheers, and gasps could be heard in the meeting room. The city will pay $7.5 million to the descendants, and Prosper Portland will add another $1 million. It amounts to around $327,000 for each of the 26 descendants listed on the lawsuit. Legal settlements from cities are often paid from a pool of money separate from the general fund. The settlement states that the city of Portland acknowledges it engaged in, quote, systemic discrimination and displacement that harmed Black communities, end quote. The actions of the city and Emmanuel Hospital were said to deny Black Portlanders homeownership that contributes to generational wealth, while contributing to segregation. Finally, the zoning codes and lending practices used by the city perpetuated harmful stereotypes, according to the settlement. In addition to the financial settlement, the agreement requires the city to turn over ownership of two parcels of land in North Portland to the descendants at no cost. Three plots have been identified for consideration. The settlement also has a clause directing the city to declare a Descendants' Day starting this year, which will run for at least 5 years. It also includes a condition that should the Keller Auditorium continue on a path to renovation, at least two of the descendants will be included in the renovation and design committees. Ira Keller, for whom the auditorium was named, was the first chairman of what is now known as Prosper Portland in the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
1,000 Friends of Oregon has made a call to action for 5 bills to be accepted that would assist in making housing more accessible. House Bills 21-38, 31-45, and 30-31 are all connected by requesting more funding to build, maintain, and expand requirements for housing. Senate Bill 51 would also work in tandem with the House bills by requiring funds to be sent to the Housing Development Center. The final bill, Senate Bill 684, seeks to establish a program to issue low-interest, short-term loans for the construction of mixed-income housing. The bills are currently all awaiting deliberation in the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. These bills would not only make housing more accessible for regular people, but also reduce homelessness. This push for more housing accessibility works well in tandem with Mayor Keith Wilson's plan to reduce homelessness by pushing for more shelters and programs. Homelessness has put an exorbitant strain on the city, Mayor Wilson states, that Portland's homelessness issue is, quote, the biggest humanitarian crisis our city has ever faced, end quote. Currently, there are no meetings scheduled for deliberation on any of the bills.
The Portland Central City Task Force wants to start building 2,500 houses before 2030. Josh Salem has more on the story for KABU.
Downtown Portland has been in trouble for some time. COVID-19-related pandemic closures threatened a host of businesses as workers transitioned to telecommuting from home. Social gatherings like concerts were largely banned. And shoppers turned to Amazon and other online vendors instead of patronizing brick-and-mortar businesses. 5 years later, the city faces compounding challenges of houselessness, addiction, housing affordability, and continuing office vacancies. All of this is hampering the city's economic recovery from the pandemic. Governor Tina Kotek has attempted to rectify the problem. In 2023, Kotek created the Portland Central City Task Force, made up of elected officials, business leaders, and representatives from nonprofits and academic organizations. The group put out a list of initial recommendations about 15 months ago, focused on crime, houselessness, trash problems, and other barriers to doing business in Portland. Now, the task force wants us to break ground on 2,500 new homes by 2030. Earlier in the week, Portland Mayor Keith Wilson spoke for the task force, pitching the housing goal and other aspirations to business and philanthropic leaders at the Portland Metro Chamber's annual luncheon. Wilson said, "This report, our goals and the purpose is clear. We must advance projects, remove the blockers, report the progress, and keep everybody at the table," end quote. He laid out additional goals, which are part of the group's vision for how to make progress over the next 5 years. Wilson acknowledges it's an uphill battle. He has talked about the weakening tax base and erosion of public trust. Certainly, downtown homelessness remains a big concern for businesses and, in general, Oregon residents, as reflected in multiple surveys. In January, a Portland Metro Chamber economic survey of 700 Portlanders found that homelessness, affordable housing, cost of living, and safety are the most critical issues facing the city. Estimates from the City of Portland show the number of people experiencing unsheltered homelessness shot up 65% between 2015 and 2023. More recent data suggests homelessness grew by nearly 25% in Multnomah County from January 2024 to January 2025. The combination of growing homelessness and shrinking business activity has caused state and city leaders to warn of irreversible damage if Portland doesn't reverse course. Overall, the task force has identified dozens of projects already in the works that could help advance its goals. Work underway near the Moda Center and at the Lloyd Center site promises new businesses, a music venue, and more than 2,000 new homes in coming years. Many of the proposed projects are supported through a mix of public and private funds. For KABU News, I'm Josh Salem.
Oregon lawmakers are deliberating on a bill that will affect how journalists handle defamation lawsuits. KABU's David Shuttenden has more on the story.
Oregon lawmakers are looking to pass a bill that will change how defamation lawsuits are held against journalists. House Bill 3564 was sponsored by freshman lawmaker Darren Harbick, the only bill that he introduced during his legislative session. The bill would change the amount of time people have to act if they feel they have been defamed from 20 days to 60 days, while publishers will still have only 14 days to correct the infringement. The bill passed in the House unanimously on April 7th after its first hearing on March 18th, with 9 written testimonies in support. On May 8th, a Senate hearing was held where 17 written testimonies were submitted. Only 3 were in support, and the rest was in opposition to the bill. Julia Shumway from the Oregon Legislative Correspondents Association states in her testimony, quote, House Bill 3564 could have a chilling effect on reporters' ability to do their jobs, especially as newsroom budgets shrink. On May 20th, an amendment voted on by the Senate would instead keep current Oregon law while adding digital news outlets within its description. A third reading is scheduled to happen on Monday, June 9th on the Senate floor. The bill has roots attached to the January 6th insurrection. Harbick's son and legislative aide, Tyler Harbick, had attended the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, according to an article published by Eugene Weekly. Tyler Harbick and his lawyer had formally asked and received a correction to the story written by the newspaper about his involvement within the insurrection. For the KBOO Evening News, I'm David Chittenden.
You are listening to a summer membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $50,000 by June 29th. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. Tonight is the first Friday Art Walk. KBOO Community Radio presents the Queer Joy Fest at the Foster Food Carts from 6 to 10 p.m. tonight. There will be live music, vendors, artists, tarot readers, food, and drinks. Tonight's weather will be a high of 85 and a low of 54 degrees. This weekend will be hot, with a high tomorrow of 87 degrees and 95 degrees on Sunday. Today, in 1930, frozen foods were sold commercially for the first time. The quote of the day is from Christopher Hitchens. He said, quote, "Non-intervention does not mean that nothing happens. It means that something else happens."
Portland's population took a big hit during the COVID-19 pandemic of 2020. Now, 5 years later, the population seems to be slowly growing back. In 2 separate studies, researchers at Portland State University and the U.S. Census Bureau say Portland's population grew by 0.2% in 2024. The Bureau recorded 653,166 residents, adding a little over 1,400 people between July 23 and July 24. While PSU recorded a slight increase of just 800 from their data in 2023. Downtown foot traffic increased, as per a report from Downtown Portland Clean and Safe. With the combined population bump and more people visiting downtown, Portland just may avoid the, quote, urban doom loop, predicted by Eco-Northwest economist Mike Wilkerson. The larger Portland metro area that includes all 3 metro counties and Clark County, Washington, experienced greater population growth. Celeste Delb, a statistician with the U.S. Census Bureau's Population Division, says, quote, "Many population growth rates reversed or saw major changes between 2023 and 2024. Cities in the Northeast that had experienced population declines in 2023 are now experiencing significant population growth on average. In fact, cities of all sizes in all regions showed faster growth and larger gains in 2023, except for small cities in the South, whose average population growth rate remained the same," end quote. Statewide, census research says the state of Oregon grew by roughly 18,000 to 4.27 million people as of July 2024. Portland State's research shows a slightly lower estimated population of 13,000. Both figures represent a population increase of less than 0.5%.
While many Oregonians may be looking into installing solar panels to lower their utility bills, experts say not all solar companies are trustworthy and explain how to make sure consumers are empowered. Isabel Charlet has more on the story.
As utility rates rise in Oregon, data shows home solar panels are becoming more popular. However, experts warn of increasing misinformation and unethical practices in solar financing and installation. Jamie Seymour is with Energy Trust of Oregon, a nonprofit that helps people and businesses save money by becoming more energy efficient. She warns against misleading door-to-door salespeople, cold calls, or social media ads that make false claims about partnerships with local utilities or use unclear pricing language.
They may make claims like, with current tax credits and incentives, your installation will be virtually free. They'll use a lot of phrases like $0 out of pocket or never pay an energy bill again.
Seymour says it is important to work with a trusted contractor for any solar installations, and Energy Trust has an online form to help people find one in their area. Currently, a federal tax credit can cover up to 30% of solar installation costs. Seymour notes this credit can be combined with Energy Trust's incentives for both solar panels and batteries. She adds higher incentives are available for low to moderate income households.
There is more support than ever before, especially here in Oregon, but that support doesn't require you to make a rush decision or act fast.
Seymour emphasizes that going solar should feel empowering because it's a step toward greater energy resilience. She advises homeowners to research thoroughly, compare multiple quotes, and avoid high-pressure sales tactics. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Musk's criticism of the big budget bill gets support from a new report. States face massive cuts to jobs and social programs, and Puerto Rico takes less damage from federal budget cuts due to its territorial status. With that story and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We obviously respect everything that Elon did with Doge. On this particular issue, we have a difference of opinion.
Senate Majority Leader John Thune says new projections from the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office are guiding billionaire and former presidential advisor Elon Musk's criticism of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. CBO says the budget reconciliation would add almost $2.5 trillion to the debt over 10 years, mostly through extending tax breaks benefiting the wealthy. Musk calls it an abomination and is now feuding with President Donald Trump on social media. Democrats and some moderate Republicans are criticizing it for gutting safety net programs. The Musk-Trump fight has gotten ugly. Musk says the White House is refusing to release files about dead sex offender Jeffrey Epstein because Trump appears in them. Trump is threatening to cancel federal contracts for Musk's companies. The bill would cost states billions. New York would lose more than $15 billion annually and see 1.5 million people kicked off of Medicaid, cuts that could hit hospitals hard. The Fiscal Policy Institute estimates it would eliminate 215,000 jobs in the state, nearly 80,000 in healthcare, and more than 130,000 in other sectors. Nathan Gusdorf is with the Institute.
The act will also reduce federal funding for food stamps, or SNAP, a program that keeps 3 million low-income New Yorkers from going hungry. But it requires state governments to fill in these spending gaps, which could cost New York State up to $2.1 billion annually.
One place somewhat spared would be Puerto Rico due to its territorial status. Rather than getting funds based on need, the island gets a low level of fixed federal Medicaid support, which wouldn't change. And George Laws Garcia with the Puerto Rico Statehood Council says they were concerned by cuts to nutrition assistance, but he says in part because of not being a state, their safety net programs are much less generous.
SNAP offers significantly lower benefit to people in Puerto Rico, even if they have the same level or even higher levels of poverty than their fellow citizens stateside.
He says Puerto Rico's programs have long needed to do more on its high child poverty and worsening childhood nutrition rates. The Affordable Care Act did increase the territory's Medicaid funding, but did not bring it in line with that of states. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says he's worried about what he calls a sinister part of the bill. A one-sentence provision could weaken U.S. judges' power to enforce contempt when government officials defy court orders. Schumer says this isn't just a policy difference, but a direct assault on the separation of powers.
This is an assault on the rule of law, an assault on the independence of the judiciary, and on the very checks and balances that have defined this country since its inception.
He says Democrats will fight that provision as well as numerous others, including cuts to American staples like PBS and NPR. And some House Republicans may have buyer's remorse about legislation they passed by a single vote. Close Trump ally Georgia Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene says she regrets voting for the bill due to a measure in it that would prevent states from regulating the use of artificial intelligence for a decade. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Oak Flat is set to become one of the biggest copper mines in the world following a U.S. Supreme Court decision not to hear the case last month, but the Apache people who consider it to be a sacred site are still fighting to protect it. With that story and more, it's Jill Freitas with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas, filling in for Antonia Gonzalez. We're continuing to dive into the history of Oak Flat, a site sacred to Native people. Located in Arizona, it may soon be home to one of the largest copper mines in the world. Apache people continue to fight to protect it. KJZZ's Gabriel Piatterazio reports.
An 1871 order from President Ulysses S. Grant established the San Carlos Apache Reservation. This led to rounding up thousands of Apaches, including Geronimo, and marching them to Hell's 40 Acres under military occupation. Some even refer to it as a concentration camp. At that time, the U.S. viewed Apaches as a monolith, but these communities are made up of complex kinship networks of bands and clans, like Tonto, Yavapai, Chiricahua, and many more. Mactima says not all of them got along.
Obviously, when you bring all these different people together on the reservation, there's going to be some ancient cultural clashes, because there was no Apache nation that didn't exist. We wouldn't have ever confined ourselves in that way at all.
Here's history professor Shepard.
So you get this flurry of executive orders, but it's also tied with the just horribly violent clampdown on Apaches in the Southwest. They're really waging a military, but also a bureaucratic war on Apaches as a people, but also upon their land.
Their reservation changed size 6 times, and Mactima says mineral wealth was a driving motivator.
And of course, that means the extermination of Apache peoples in the region.
Shepard says that's not hyperbole.
Rounding people up, concentrating them on reservations, deporting them. And as that happens, we start to see the emergence of that federal land management regime take over the territory as public domain.
In 1955, President Dwight D. Eisenhower incorporated Oak Flat into the Tonto National Forest, where it remains to this day. And Mactima believes if Apaches remained nomadic and weren't restricted to reservations,
Oak Flat would still become a very prominent place for Apaches to travel to.
Gabriel Piatterazio, Phoenix.
Devastating wildfires across Western Canada have forced thousands of people from their homes, including those in Indigenous communities. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, for many First Nations, the crisis is one of temporary accommodation.
According to the latest statistics, and they change quickly, more than 30,000 people in Saskatchewan and Manitoba have been forced to leave their homes and are displaced. Hundreds of homes have been destroyed, many Indigenous people have been flown out of remote communities, and satellite images show that in some regions the situation is worsening. In Winnipeg, Manitoba's largest city, there isn't much left. Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs Grand Chief Kyra Wilson says the situation has become dire.
And we see young children and families waiting, in whatever environment that they're in, waiting to go to, you know, their secondary accommodation, whatever that is, whether that's one of the congregate shelters, whether that's a hotel, whether that's out of province. And it's really sad to see, you know, our children having to sleep on floors. People are sitting, waiting in hallways, waiting outside. And right now, we just need everybody to come together.
In Ottawa, the federal government has deployed military personnel to help fight the fires. Officials say the firefighting service has now been stretched to the maximum, and the call has gone out to Canada's international partners for help. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
I'm Jill Freitas.
The Imperial Valley lithium boom raises hopes and concerns for locals. The region is home to vast amounts of lithium, a mineral critical for battery manufacturing. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In the Imperial Valley region of Southern California, deep groundwater reservoirs contain vast amounts of lithium. This mineral is critical for making batteries, and demand for it is growing as the electric car industry expands. multiple companies are developing plans to extract that lithium, and one project has broken ground.
It's quite possible that this area is on the precipice of a major boom that could bring significant economic activity. But whether or not it actually benefits the residents is much more uncertain.
Manuel Pastor of the University of Southern California is co-author of a new book about the emerging lithium industry in the Imperial Valley and how it could affect the largely low-income Latino communities nearby. Local groups are pushing for companies to commit to strong environmental protections and to hiring and training residents for jobs the industry creates. And they help lobby for a tax on lithium extraction that will create significant revenue for communities. Pastor says these are steps in the right direction.
The fact that these companies have begun to fully realize that in order to do well, everybody in that region needs to do well gives me hope.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to a summer membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is David Chittenden, Dave Johnson, John Nelson, Dejan, and Josh Salem. The producer is Hannah Francis, and our engineer is Jasmine Moss. Special thanks to Jill Freitas, Isabel Charlet, Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and Edwin J. Vieira. The interim evening news director is Hannah Francis. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You were listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath,